Welcome to Mastering Agility. If you want to listen to authentic conversations with the most inspiring guests, find like-minded people in the Mastering Agility Discord community or both online and face-to-face events, this is the platform for you. Grab a drink, sit back, and join professional scrum trainers Sander Doerr, Jim Sammons, and their guests in an all-new episode.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm happy to be here and I'm plowed out, so life is good.
I don't know if that's a euphemism for drinking or actual snow.
No, we had it snowed for like 50 hours straight. We had 2 feet of snow. And
really?
Yeah, I was trapped in my house by the snow for a few days.
Oh, wow.
And then when I finally did get out, I drove into a snowbank I was trying to make a turn and I slid in it. But I'm plowed out, I'm towed out, and I'm happy to be here.
We haven't had snow in this country for years, like not proper snow like that, unfortunately. I wish I had. Like, my kids would have loved that. Esther, I would like to take you back a couple of weeks to the Scan Agile conference, and you were asked what your superpower was just before diving onto stage. Could you take us through your answer and what followed?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to be able to recreate it exactly, but word for word. But I was asked, what is your superpower? And I feel like my superpower is empathy. I think what's interesting about that for me is I did not grow up in a family that had a lot of empathy. So it is something I learned to do. I incorporated that into my life, and now I feel like it's, it just happens very naturally. But everybody is born with the capacity for empathy. It is innate, unless, your brain's not wired correctly. They've done lots of studies where even tiny, tiny babies, like even pre-verbal, they recognize when something is unfair. They've done little studies where they have little puppets and one puppet will be mean to the other puppet and the babies don't like it, right? So they empathize with those characters even when they're very, very tiny. So it is in everybody unless it gets squashed out. And I think it is, particularly in business, we tend not to think about empathy as being important. But it is super important. There's some new research that shows that it's really an important skill for leaders. It's certainly important for people in our field to have empathy for the people whose, programs we're changing or the software we're building for them. We have to be able to empathize with them in order to be good at our jobs.
I'm curious, could you define... Like if we were to bump into you in a social setting and somebody is like, I don't know that I know what that word means. Could you tell us briefly like what empathy is and maybe what it is not or how it relates to related concepts?
Sure. So I think there are different kinds of empathy. There's emotional empathy, which is the one we usually think about. And that's the ability to... not necessarily have the same feelings as someone else. It doesn't mean feeling the same thing, but it means recognizing that their feelings are valid, right? Recognizing their feelings and that they're valid. And there's point of view empathy, which says, I can see how it looks from your point of view. So being able to kind of put yourself in someone else's situation. You can't do that fully, but you can do that to some extent. And then cognitive empathy is saying, I see how you're thinking about that. Mm. Right. So people get confused because they think empathy means you're always coddling people. Mm. And that is not what it is. It's not about coddling people. It's about seeing their response as valid. Even if you don't agree with it, right? You at least acknowledge it's valid. It doesn't mean you have to fix it. I think that's the other confusion people have is that if they see someone who is upset, they feel like they have to fix it. You don't have to fix it. And often actually just empathizing with it is enough to lessen the intensity and help people, refocus on something else. So I know that my life works better when, I, when I engage in empathy. Works a lot better.
Now, you mentioned that this is has been kind of dragged out of you, the empathy, that you didn't grow up with empathy in your family. But when I see you, when we met, you seem like one of the most empathetic people that I've met so far. Like, you're really down to earth. You advocate approachability. How did you get back to that point? Because if you're born with it, then it gets dragged out, and now you're at this stage. How did you get back to that?
Conscious practice and valuing it. Yeah. I mean, it was a conscious choice and a practice. So I would say, maybe I've rediscovered the innate empathy I had, but for a time, it was a conscious practice.
Can you have too much empathy? Because I remember a discussion a few years ago with somebody who, now I wasn't directly involved, I was just in the conversation, and they told another person there, you have too much empathy, you're over-indexing on empathy. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I've been involved in several conversations about that. So empathy is bad. I think that's a boundary issue. So, along with empathy, we need to have boundaries, right? Like, you are a different person than me. We are not the same. I am not having your feelings. I am not responsible for your feelings. I can offer you this. I can't offer you more than that. So I think that's my not being in that conversation. That's my hypothesis, that people often mistake lack of boundaries for too much empathy.
Now, you've been writing a lot about change in the organizations. Mm-hmm. To what degree is empathy needed? Like, is that a requirement to get to the positive change that we're trying to get?
That's an interesting question. So I'm going to tell you a story, because I have a lot of stories.
I like stories.
And I try to remember the relevant ones. I try not to tell just like random stories about people you will never meet. Although you'll never meet these people. So I was at a local networking roundtable kind of thing a few years ago. And this woman was complaining about how badly a change in her organization had gone. And she worked for a big hospital system. And she was saying, all these people are complaining, and we're doing this change for better patient care, saving costs so we can put more money into patient care. Who could be against that? Why are they resisting? And she was just couldn't understand. And what came out in the story, and I asked some questions, was they eliminated a number of nurse manager positions. And most nurse managers, or many nurse managers, go through special additional education to qualify for that job, after they've finished their nursing training and they've been a nurse for some time. They go get extra education to qualify for that position. And it's a different kind of work, and they're no longer on the floor, so it's not as hard on their body, and it's a career move they've invested in. And she hadn't considered any of that. that for the people who were, being asked to go back to a floor, well, you still have a job back on the floor. She hadn't considered that for them, it was a loss of status. It was perhaps going back to something that was going to be hard on their bodies at middle age. This nursing is actually extremely hard on the body. It's one of lots and lots of workplace injuries in that field. Loss of prospects of advancement. So she didn't consider the losses that they experienced at all, right? To her, it was just, well, we're going to save money, better patient care. So, my guess is that, better patient care was reduced to numbers in that case. But, so that's one of the reasons I think it's important, is you have to understand the impact of the change of people is going to have on the people you're asking to change or you're requiring to change, right?
Yeah. One of the comments I get from listeners a lot is they love the topics we talk about on here, but sometimes they feel unapproachable. They get stressed or anxious between maybe where they think they're at and whatever our guest is talking about. So do you have any practical tips for somebody who's like, I don't know how empathetic I am, or how can I practice this? Is there Like, do you have a story or a reflection on like a simple tip that you could give to someone?
Well, ask how would this look to someone else? How would this look from their point of view? What's the gain and the loss for this person? I mean, so now I have another story. So, like I said, you know, I didn't grow up in an empathetic family, and I was really logical, and I had my first flow charting template when I was 9 years old. My father bought it. You know, I don't remember. You probably don't remember those Aqua flow charting templates. My mother was a teacher. And my father was a bureaucrat, so they were automating the whatever processes. So I started flow charting things at a very, very early age, and you know really analytical. And when I became a programmer, when my first programming job, I was working for a small company, and we automated the process of producing estimates for this light manufacturing company. And it was real mathy, and you know, there was a lot that went into it. And when the program was done, it was tested. The chief estimator agreed that it was correct. And it was ready to go into production. And I overheard him talking to the owner of the company saying, you know, I don't want to use that program. And it wasn't because it was wrong. It wasn't because it would slow him down. It was because it changed his job. And his way of doing estimates had always involved, you know, a lot of back of the envelope, talking to the customer, talking to the guys on the shop floor, you know. So it was a social thing for him. There's a big social element. And this wonderful program meant that he would be sitting at a desk, maybe talking to people on the phone. And that was, you know, a big wake up for me. You know, to say, yeah, you have to see this from someone else's point of view. You know, because this wonderful program we thought was going to be so helpful to him was not, you know, in some ways, absolutely not helpful. So what does this look like from someone else's point of view? What are they gaining? What are they losing?
I think the product design people in our audience and in the industry, you know, they have words for this, right? Customer journey mapping and empathy mapping and user interviews and observation. But it could be as simple as you're saying, which is asking somebody, what do you think of this? Why don't you want to use it? How could we make it more useful? And I don't know about you two, but I know that sometimes when I read about these ideas, like any of those I just rattled off, they might seem big and scary and difficult and like I'm going to have to completely go back to school for 3 months to learn how to do them. And they could start as simple as you're describing, Esther, like talking to the person who's going to use that thing and say, what do you like about this? What don't you like about this?
But equally, we see it's hard for a lot of people to approach our stakeholders or the users that we work with to ask them, what do you think? Or this is the way that I think you're perceiving this, or the way that you know, empathy mapping, for instance, trying to look through the perspective of others. And then you do that. And then many people stick to just that, like the attempt, and then stop working or stop verifying those assumptions. So what is that threshold that keeps us from validating our perspectives with others?
Well, I mean, in many organizations, it's structural, you know. They make it very difficult to talk to their customers. I've been in organizations where people were prohibited from talking to their customers. And there's a few instances where that made sense. I mean, I knew some people who were designing weapon systems for planes, and, you know, there was like top secret stuff. So there was a wall there. But very often they make it difficult. And I think sometimes it's difficult because we speak different languages, right? And we may not know how to talk about things in a way that is accessible. And when we, you know, I have observed this in our field, it may not be true for the people listening, but very often, you know, people get caught up in tech talk. And then the other people don't understand it. And the assumption is they don't understand because they're not very bright, which is not the case. but jargon gets in the way. Yeah, there are a lot of barriers, and I said something once about talking to customers, and someone came back and said, "I would never let my programmers talk to a customer. I would never let them talk to a customer." Well, you know, why is that? I mean, in this particular case, I mean, she said it was because all of her programmers were on the spectrum. And she didn't think their social skills were up to it, which I think is kind of bogus. I mean, I know plenty of people who are on the spectrum, but, you know, they're fine.
Yeah, I think I've heard that before. And it's interesting because when I pull on that thread a little bit and say why, it's normally either what you just said, which is my developers can't talk to people. And then sometimes it's, I don't want the customers to talk to the people doing the execution, because then they'll ask a bunch of hard questions or they're not allowed to. And there's a number of techniques to just like start to investigate if that's actually true or not, or if there's a bunch of misunderstanding and just false barriers put in place. And I think your comment about jargon is really important, because people talking over or under each other is a common problem. And I would be curious what your tips are, but what I've seen is I tend to try and help balance that as maybe the facilitator or the moderator, and say, I think you're too high or too low, because people don't want to be condescended to. And I think some people see empathy as too condescending. And jargon is too high. So it's really about, can we have layman's terms or, you know, like common language discussions about complex topics with highly intelligent people? Because intelligence is rarely the problem. It's not about, do we have smart people? I tell my customers, I only work with smart people. But just because you're smart in this topic doesn't mean you know how to communicate to Esther, who's smart in other topics.
Right. And the fact that they aren't smart in computer science or software or programming doesn't mean they're not smart. So now I have another story. So I was working in a bank, and the programmers are complaining that the users were too stupid to use their interface. So I said, and these are people with MBAs, so they're not stupid. You know, they're CPAs and MBAs. They're smart people. Mm-hmm. And so I asked to see their interface, and it was in hexadecimal. So no wonder they couldn't understand it.
Isn't it equally interesting that people get perceived to be too stupid to do their jobs while they get hired to do their jobs, and they are the ones getting blamed, while apparently it's the hiring manager that in that case would do a pretended sucky job in hiring these people? Now we've got a question coming from the audience from Miriam.
Oh, great.
She said, you mentioned talking about different, we often talk in different languages in the sense of jargon, but how about really speaking different languages and cultural backgrounds, and how does that work with the three types of empathy? Interesting question.
Yeah, well, I think on a you know, human psychological basis, there you know, that empathy thing from the research I've seen is pretty universal. So as an adult language learner, I would say be willing to slow down, be willing to rephrase, be willing to ask more questions. Because even people who are very, very proficient in a language aren't always proficient in all areas of a language. And, you know, the cultural issues are going to be very different. So you have to be super sensitive to those. I don't know if that's actually getting to the question, but
mastering agility only works with organizations aligned with our values. And that's exactly why we are excited to work with our sponsor. Scrum Match is a free platform for professionals run by professionals. On Scrum Match, true Scrum Masters get hired by companies serious about their popular framework. The awesome people behind this platform have decades of experience, among them a professional Scrum trainer for Scrum.org. They've interviewed, trained, and coached hundreds of like-minded people, and they use this exact experience to make you stand out from the crowd and help you get in touch with companies looking for true Scrum Masters. So go to scrummatch.com and sprint to your dream job. How easy is it to empathize with someone that you don't understand the cultural background? Just as an example, and Miriam made a valid point there, as Dutch people, we often work with people from a lot of different nationalities in a single team. Now, India, for instance, has a very different background or culture than we have.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it sometimes hard to really understand and see the points of view that those people are going through or that they experience and the other way around.
Yeah. So a long time ago, I did this thing. I don't remember what it's called. It was a thing that looked at values. And what it said was that there are actually shared values across all cultures. They're just prioritized differently. So it's, I think it's helpful to find out what those shared values are and try to connect on those. And just be aware of what some of the differences are and recognize that we may have to calibrate. I can, you know, I've worked in cultures that are super direct, and I've worked with people who come from cultures where being super direct is just a sign of great disrespect. And I can see where that would cause a clash. And I think it requires a little willingness to flex on both parts and to be aware of differences and expand your style or add to your repertoire of how you approach people.
Mm-hmm. You know, this question and one of the others in the chat is kind of reminding me of something recently, which is I'm doing some work with one company, and there's a lot of folks from India, and they're almost never on camera. And a number of leaders and other coaches and just other people are like, oh, why are they never on camera? I want them on camera more and all this. And I said, you know, I just told a story from my past where people were not proud of their background. They would log into a call, maybe Esther, with someone like you or one of their executives, and see this massive American home in the background with, you know, opulence, and they were not proud. And I said, it could be just that. Like, how can you make it safe? Let's not assume that they're not on camera because they're not interested or not engaged or not paying attention.
Yeah. There's a lot of reasons. I mean, it could be that their Wi-Fi isn't great, and so they're, you know, they don't want to expend the bandwidth on video. It could be that they have family in the background. A lot of people from other cultures often live in multi-generational households, and the house sizes are smaller. And so there's people in the background. There's tons of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I know I, at one point, was, you know, thought that camera on was a good idea for engagement and the ability to see cues, but I've really come to think it's if forcing people to be on camera removes their autonomy and doesn't respect the fact that, like you say, sometimes people it creates more friction and discomfort because it emphasizes that status difference. Right? It's just re-emphasizing that status difference, which Sander talked about earlier, that, and you mentioned, you know, if you're, nobody likes to be condescended to and nobody likes to be down-statused.
And it's a balance because there, you know, as trainers, you know, when I'm training, which I'm not always doing, I definitely don't do it as much as, you know, my co-host does, but
yeah,
it does make for more difficult training at times. So I tend to, and I'm not saying this is the right answer, is I tend to tell people that being engaged is far more important than being on camera. But I may have a different experience. You may have a different experience. Yeah. Other students may have a different experience if no one's on camera, because you are missing some of that richness. And, but yeah, I think I agree with you. It's not really about camera versus not camera. It's about understand empathy, to bring this back to your, and the reason I bring this up is to come back to your original superpower, is could just be as simple as asking someone, I notice you're not on camera. Here's why I've not been comfortable being on camera in the past, or here's a story I had, and making it about you, or just making it safe to do something differently like that.
Yeah, well, I think having the discussion up front is helpful. You know, camera optional. We all have a lot of reasons that we may not want to be on camera. I mean, you know, there's one woman who didn't want to be on camera because she'd had a cancerous thing removed from her nose and she had a huge bandage on her nose and she just didn't want to be on camera with that. I mean, people have all sorts of reasons, which are valid, right? They're totally valid. You know.
But equally, it's sometimes it's really hard for people to speak up about these things, or whether it's on the other side of the person that we try to empathize with. And then how do we change that? Because what happens in a lot of organizations, not just organizations as in corporates, but just in general, like in our society, is that we get a lot of backtalk. And, you know, this person is condescending to me, but I don't know how to speak up. And then it stays in this infinite loop that we cannot change.
I'm thinking about how I want to say that, because it is easy to get stuck in a trap and to start withdrawing or start thinking that this is a bad person. And so what I often do is like say, okay, I understand that part of it. Here's the part I don't understand. And so I might try to bring attention to what is the shared knowledge here and what's the area where we don't have shared knowledge. So that that's one of those things that tends to equalize, because it in some ways shows up that we both know stuff that the other one doesn't, right? And that's always an issue in status, right?
What is that thing that makes it so hard for us to bring that across? Well, it's so easy to focus on like the product, the core competency skills that we need to do to develop a product, mm-hmm. rather than the soft skills that we need to work as a team to make sure that we as an organization work highly performant.
Why is that so hard to do?
Yeah, like what is the thing that keeps us from focusing more on the soft skills, mm-hmm. like these interpersonal things that are more profound to the way that we actually live, that we are as species, yet we overlook that?
Yeah, well, there's a period of time, I could put my hand on the research for this, but it would take me a while, or the discussion of this. There was a time when, probably in the 80s, I'm thinking, probably in the 80s, where it was very common for in interviews to use empathy as an elimination factor. So the thinking was, programming is very logical. We need people who are very logical. And people who were, you know, inclined to think more about other people's points of view and to focus on interpersonal skills and social skills were screened out. You know, and I think we are still reeling from that in our profession. I think one of the other things that happened is, when did people start getting personal computers? I think I probably had my first portable computer in the early 80s. It weighed 50 pounds, so it was not very portable. But there was a period in the late 80s, early 90s, was it, when people's, you know, computers got smaller? Yeah, that's probably the early 90s.
Somewhere around that area.
And people started getting computers for Christmas. I shouldn't say people, because it was mostly boys. And they would go off to their bedroom and they'd play with their computer and they'd learn how to program. Girls tended not to be given computers as gifts. They did not tend to have computers in their bedrooms, so they weren't up. And there weren't that many games that girls would be attracted to, because they were mostly focused on boys, although, you know, Pac-Man, you know, who knows? Anyway, and I don't want to reinforce the stereotype that there are boy games and girl games, but what happened from that was that by the time kids went to college, you know, so 6 years later, 7 years later, they went to college. The boys had been around computers for many years and they knew something about programming. And we'd get to CompSci 101 and they knew a lot of the concepts and the girls hadn't been exposed to them. But it was not assumed that it was a lack of exposure. It was assumed that it was a lack of ability or affinity or suitability for those concepts. And so they often washed out, you know, particularly if you were looking at a curve, you know, they might not have done as well simply because they had not been exposed. They had not had the years of practice. And so that tended to deter a whole cohort of women from going into computer science. And by then you have a situation where, you know, we've selected against empathy and we have not consciously, but without awareness, perhaps changed the selection, the self-selection in. And there you have it. You know, we have what we have. But I think it's also changing. I think we're going,
luckily,
we're going back to having a broader range of people who are in the field, and at least in the agile world, really valuing the ability to work in a collaborative way. So
yeah, even there, I still see some friction going on with the agile coaches that we have, and then they advocate for more empathy in the workplace and a more human approach, if you will,
yeah,
versus a very corporate mindset that still thinks, well, we can just, you know, just program, add this little button or do this, or everything is very straightforward, right? So creating more focus on the more interpersonal skills, yeah, is still fairly hard.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I'm personally in the process of getting more into a mentalization and vocalization field so that I can process my thoughts better into vocalizing, mm-hmm, them, which is typically apparently a lot harder for men than for women. So it's interesting to see that dynamic, yeah, as well, to change that, yeah, because that's part of that hiring process that you just described as well, where mostly traditionally men were part of the hiring process. And if that's already kind of scrapping the barrel when it comes to empathy, then it's going to be even harder to get back on par.
Yeah, well, there's all sorts of interesting things about the hiring dynamics too. There was this, I read a study that when, you know, if you have one candidate that is of a different group, whether that is a racial or ethnic minority or whether it's a woman, if you have only one diverse candidate, their chance of being hired is extremely low. But if you have two or more diverse candidates in your pool, their chances go up dramatically.
Mm.
So that's an interesting fact I think would be helpful for people to be aware of. I was also talking recently to a guy who has been hired to kind of shift the culture of his firm. And his firm is... I think it was Cliff Hazel who used this phrase at the Scan Agile conference we were both at. Pale and stale. They're pale and stale. So they're old white men.
Yeah, that was Cliff. Yeah. That's when he showed that picture of the, what was it? The Board for Women's Rights of US, consistent of all white middle-aged men, yeah, Mike Pence and cohorts.
Yeah.
It was very interesting to see that.
Yeah, yeah. So, but anyway, where was I going with that? So he was hired to shift the culture, it's going to be hard if they only have one like young woman, right, in a company that is really all male, all middle-aged men. It's going to be hard. So numbers matter, right? And then not expecting the person who is different to be like everybody else. There's a actually very, very well respected engineering firm in the town where I live. And they were very, very intentional about hiring young women engineers. But then they would say, but they don't know how to do it. They're conflict averse. They don't know how to duke it out in a meeting. And they failed to recognize that there was a really different style of handling conflict at work. So the women would go around and talk to people and figure out what their concerns were and address the concerns and address their proposal and so forth and so on. And so by the time they got to the meeting, it was like, oh, everybody's pretty much in agreement. So they didn't need to have these duke them out kind of fights, but it was viewed as, oh, well, they don't know how to do conflict. It was like they did things very differently.
Exactly.
And I think that's another thing that we need to, and that goes back to Miriam's question about culture, right? They may do it differently, handle it differently. We need to be aware of it.
Is that the reason why you wrote the book on your latest book on change as well?
You know, that came about after years of observing change. I mean, you know, in some ways, my observation of change started with that program that I wrote that was, you know, wrecking this guy's job. Which wasn't my intention. So, you know, I'd been observing it for years. And one of the patterns that I have that has become very clear to me is that very often people try to install a process to fix a problem, you know, so they have an existing system and then they slap a process over it and hope it will fix everything. I have seen that happen with Agile so many times. You know, but if you don't address what was causing the pattern, it's going to reassert itself. And I've seen that happen many times. But I've also seen it happen long before Agile. I mean, I saw that happen many times when I was a corporate employee. Like, oh, new methodology. Oh, well, now we call documents work products. And we have these binders. And the same patterns would reassert themselves because the factors that influence the patterns had not been addressed. And a methodology wasn't going to fix it. And the same is true with Agile.
You talked about jargon before. Is that one of those things that in organizations, we just feel so comfortable digging into new jargon and like running around with fancy terms without truly understanding how the implications change? And we are just the cool kids on the block that have the new coolest Nikes. So we are the only ones who understand the new jargon and not actually change anything.
Well, it is a normal process for people to hang new information on their existing cognitive frameworks. That is what people do, right? They learn something new and they try to figure out how it fits in with what they already know. And that's how we end up with, you know, Scrum administrators and, you know, Agile project managers who are, you know, just like the old project managers and managers who are now Scrum masters and all that stuff. Right. It's not because people are stupid, bad, or wrong. They're doing what people do. It's they're trying to fit information into their existing framework. And a lot of the training that goes on around Agile really focuses on the external things, you know. Here's a backlog, here's a stand-up meeting, here's a this. And so it's the visible aspects, but not necessarily the thinking and philosophy that goes behind them that gets focused on in training. And, you know, there are limits to what you can do in 2 days, obviously. A lot of training is based on being able to recall terms and concepts rather than actually to deeply understand the concepts and how to apply them or how to apply them in your environment. Because there are some things that, you know, need to be adjusted. I mean, you know, you think about the Spotify model. It's like that was evolved to solve a particular set of problems. And then, you know, you may not have the same problems, so it won't necessarily work where you are.
Both Jim and I are experienced consultants and trainers. Therefore, we know how important it is for organizations to have the fundamentals in place before delivering high-value products. And this starts with understanding the theory behind whatever framework, method, or process organizations apply. And this is where Zebia comes in. Zebia is a pioneering software engineering and IT consultancy company, transforming and executing at the intersection of domain and technology to create digital leaders for our people, clients, partners, and communities. As a gift for our Mastering Agility audience, they provided us with a discount code MA10 when signing up for their open enrollment classes to get 10% off. Do you think it's that short-sightedness as well that seems to... I'm not going to say an industry-wide pandemic, also because the word pandemic might not be the best one these days anymore, but it feels like the expectation of many organizations that if we follow a 2-day course on this new framework. All of a sudden, we know everything, and we out of our 15 million employees, we'll send two to the course, and they'll be able to change the rest of the organization because now they're trained.
Well,
what's your experience with that?
So I think that goes back to a very mechanistic mental model of how organizations work. You know, I mean, I read most job descriptions, and they remind me of specifications for parts, right? So if we just tell this part to do things differently, then things will work differently. So there's a huge emphasis on explicit knowledge and a devaluing of implicit knowledge and social knowledge and collective knowledge, you know, the knowledge that exists in a team versus the knowledge that exists in individuals. So that whole implicit knowledge, that whole social knowledge is not considered. It's, you know, it's not easy to count. It's not easy to measure. And so in cultures, because there is a business culture, that tends to get devalued, right? And so, I could go on.
Your book is called The 7 Rules for Positive Productive Change. Now, over the last couple of, decades, there has been an insurgence when it comes to titles of change management and change this and change that. Now, you specifically added positive and productive change. What made you put this specifically into the title of the book?
Because I have seen so much, so many change efforts that were not productive. They were not good experiences for people. And although I think everybody hopes that the outcome of a change is going to be higher, something or other, whatever they're looking for, you know, better project performance or better numbers or better retention or whatever, it's often not. And so that's, you know, that's why I wanted to include those. I want it to be a positive experience for people, and I want, I hope that, you know, it will actually be useful, because I mean, you've probably lived through this too, where, you know, we go through this huge change effort, and at the end of it, you know, everybody's upset and everything's the same. You know, and while, you know, I say I want it to be positive, I also, one of the things that I talk about in the book is you really have to recognize that change involves loss. Like this story I told about the, you know, the hospital system, you know, those people experience a loss. There's always a negative space. But I think we can make it more respectful of everybody involved, right? Because people have different needs and priorities in organizations depending on their roles. We can make it more positive. We can make it more respectful. We can use some empathy and involve people more, because when people are involved in solving the problems, one, you get a lot more local knowledge, right, which is often super helpful. And when people have a chance to be involved in it, they are more likely to be invested in solving problems and making it work.
It's an interesting remark that you made. You said everyone's upset and nothing really changed. Now, no one seems to be upset that nothing changed.
Well, there's a certain investment in saying it was successful. I remember, one of the first times I was acutely aware of the whole, you know, we're slapping a process on something, was we had, so I was working in a big financial services firm at the time, and they had, you know, just done this whole methodology thing, and it cost a lot of money, and we all had all these binders, and, you know, and they paid a big consulting firm. You know. So the methodology was declared complete, and you know, it had solved all her problems. And the vice president, one of the vice presidents came, made a big announcement that this is now business as usual. And look at how well things are going. And those of us who were like actually involved in the computer systems really, one of our major systems that had been extensively modified using this methodology, it just crashed completely. So we're all there. Oh, yeah. Everything's better. You know, like we had major, major system crash. And, you know, projects were still late and they were still over budget. Yeah.
Well, luckily in that sense, nothing changed.
But yeah, but in his, well, it, but in, he was very invested in saying it was a success. And if you look at it from a certain point of view where results are abstracted to easily countable numbers, it probably was. You know, we, have we trained everybody in the department? Has everybody been to their two-day training? Yes. Does everybody have the binders in front of them? Yes. Are these particular work products being produced? Yes. So from those metrics, yeah, bingo, success. But nothing had really changed.
Is there an incentive to these types of well, I'm not going to say people, but these types of behavior to call it a success, and or else they would lose face? Like they have to say it's a success.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's always a certain level of, you know, people saving face, but you know, there's also like huge incentives in organizations like that. You know, it was on his bonus. Of course, it had to be a success. You know,
fair enough.
You know, so the reward structures drive those responses, as do, you know, the formal structures as well as the informal structures. I mean, it's you know, when you're at that level in the organization, the costs of not succeeding are very high, both in terms of your organizational prospects, but also psychologically, right? They're very high.
Mm.
So, I mean, I get why people do that.
It's sad that it happens, but it makes sense to a certain degree.
Yeah,
I mean, now, could you summarize those seven rules for us? What are those seven ones? And then we'll go to the audience questions.
Oh, the seven rules. You're gonna ask me to summarize? Okay. Start from congruence, because congruence is the only place from which empathy is possible, and it allows us to do our best thinking. Honor the past. And the people and the present, because however people are doing things, it has worked to some extent. It may have been the result of the last change. And people basically don't like to be, to have someone come in and tell them what they've been doing is stupid and wrong. So honor the past, present, and people. Assess what is, because if you don't know what's causing the current pattern, you don't really stand much chance of shifting it. So you really have to know where you are. People often think change starts from a vision, but it really starts from where you are today, and you have to address that. Activate networks. Networks are incredibly important in how work gets done. But they're also incredibly important in how ideas are diffused in organizations. So many changes break networks. You know, reorgs break networks. One situation I was aware of that they eliminated the lunchroom, and that broke networks. That had all sorts of downline effects because there was no more cross-pollinization. But also, you know, if the people who are highly regarded in your organization are in favor of a change, things are much easier. And if they're against it, they're much harder. So activate networks. Guide and allow for variation. Earlier I mentioned, mechanistic thinking. And mechanistic thinking has led us to just... think everything has to be standardized and everything has to be the same. No, everything has to be coherent. It doesn't have to be the same. So we have to think about how we can set up kind of guardrails and then allow for variation within that, which also ties into the fingerprint principle of if people get their hands on it, then they feel like it's theirs and they're more invested in it. So I think about, you know, if you look at a lamp, there are certain parts of that that have to be tightly specified, like where it plugs into the electrical system. Tight specifications. There are safety specifications for the wiring and the base, right? It has to, you know, be non-flammable and it has to stand up.
Mm.
And the shades also have to be non-flammable, but they can be flamboyant, right? So you have to think about how tightly something needs to be constrained versus how much freedom for movement people have. And we're not used to thinking that way, so it's kind of hard. So guide the change and allow for variation, and then experiment. Big changes cause big disruption, and little changes don't, right? And they allow for learning, and they allow people to get their fingerprints on things. So do little experiments, learn from them, figure out what works. If you can get it to work in one place, it's an excellent thing, and you've learned something. So I think did I get to seven?
You did get to seven.
Yay!
Score.
Win for me.
Highlighted today. Well, the book's for sale everywhere. 7 Rules for Positive Productive Change, Micro Shifts, Macro Results. I like that. I can highly recommend reading the book because I think this makes it so much more tangible for a lot of organizations to actually apply this. So I'll make sure that this ends up in the link ends up in the show notes.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Now, I'm going to ask Karina to come in to press the live dial-in. We've never done this on the podcast so far before, so it's a little experiment for me as well. Let's see how this goes. She had a wonderful question. Let's see. Karina, are you able to find the button for live dial-in?
So this is the question that didn't get asked at Scan Agile, right?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, excellent.
Connecting.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
Hello.
Hi, Karina. Nice to meet you.
Well, thanks for being willing to pop on like this.
So, how to encourage colleagues to consider being more empathetic to others, especially how to work on it with top managers in hierarchical companies?
One question I often ask is, well, how is this going to affect another group? You know, when something comes up, it's like, well, how will that affect them? Or how will that look to them? Or how does it look from their point of view? So I just ask that question, which I think is kind of the starter question for getting people to consider another point of view and another set of possibilities. So that's one way I start. How are people going to react to this? You know, what another question I sometimes ask is, you know, who gains and who loses from this? So sometimes I ask questions like that, depending on the context. And sometimes I'll say, oh, I read this really interesting article in Harvard Business Review about empathy as a leadership skill here. So I, you know, sometimes I give people articles. I say, oh, I read this really interesting article. Super interesting. Sometimes I just leave things for people, which was easier when we were in person.
Does that help answer your question, Karina?
Yes. Thank you.
Well, perfect. Thank you. Thank you so much for having the courage to show up in the live call-in. Now, I'm going to respectfully bring you back to the audience. Let's see. Now, before heading to the closure, because I want to be mindful of your time as well, Esther, I just want to give you one personal note as well. I've been to a very rough burnout like 8-9 years ago, and I really had to reconfigure where my energy comes from, figure out all sorts of personal stuff, and then become a Scrum Master was the first thing that... that popped to mind, but also it became my career path. And it kind of leads, the whole path leads to this point. And the first book that I ever bought was yours and Diana Larson's. So it's really awesome to see that you're here now and that you've made a massive impact on me, on my, well, pretty much both my personal and my my work life. So I really appreciate that you're here, that you're willing to answer our audience questions, but also to have this very dynamic conversation about gearing positive change. I just wanted to let you know that you've made a massive impact on me as well.
Oh, that is, you know, that is the absolute best thing that an author can hear. Really, truly, it's the absolute best thing that the work was valuable to somebody and had an impact on them. So that's very touching for me.
Glad. Thank you so much for being here, for creating all the awesome books, and for being such an awesome, humble person. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That is all for today. Thank you for listening. If you liked this episode, let us know by hitting that like button, share it with friends and colleagues, sharing a message on LinkedIn, joining our warm and welcoming Discord community, or attend recordings as a virtual audience. You can find all the relevant links in the show notes. We hope you'll tune back in for the next episode of the Mastering Agility Podcast.